Society, which we know is 1970s New York. It describes a technological, genetically engineered nightmare society, which I'll call the nightmare future, and another future, which I'll call the utopian future, because it's no life. I'm going to start off by talking about our heroine, Consuelo, or Connie, and she's a 37-year-old Mexican-American woman. And to the people of the utopian future, she's a catcher. She has telepathic abilities. She has a particularly open and receptive mind and nervous system, which enables her to time travel. And these same qualities, on top of which is the fact that she's a rebel and she's an intelligent rebel, mean that present society label her as mad and lock her up in a psychiatric institution. Another reason that makes Connie a good subject for people of the utopian future is the fact that she's got nothing to lose in this present society. She's had everything taken from her, and she's willing, certainly by the end of the book, to do anything to strike a blow at the system. She's lost everyone that she cared for. She's lost her first husband, she lost to the street, in that he was killed in a gang fight. Her lover was later died in prison. He took part in a medical experiment whereby he was injected with hepatitis and subsequently died from it. She lost her daughter, Angie, to the social services who took her away for adoption. And she even has lost her womb, in that when her second husband beat her up for the last time, she was in hospital and a hysterectomy was performed on her without her knowledge or consent. And she remembers looking down the ward and seeing a ward of black and brown women having the same thing done to them. She describes her life at the beginning, in between committals to hospital, as waking up in the morning and again bills, again hunger, again pain, again loss, again trouble. Again no Claude, again no Angelina, again the rent due, no job, no hope. So she's in a bad way at the beginning of the book. She's also on welfare and on probation. She feels the authorities have got the right to interfere in every part of her life. She has no autonomy or privacy. This is how she describes a visit from the social worker. The social worker was giving her that human to cockroach look. Most people hit kids, but if you were on welfare and on probation, and the whole social pigeonholing establishment had the right to trek regularly through your kitchen, looking in the closets and under the bed, counting the bed bugs in your shoes, you had better not hit your kid once. Now that's, of course, an agent of the state being the biggest child abuser of all, with schools and armies, and etc. She had been in hospital before, and the previous time she was in hospital was because, after the death of Claude, her lover, in prison, she took to drinking and drugs because there was no outlet for her grief in the present society. This resulted in hitting her daughter, who broke her wrist and was subsequently taken for adoption into a wealthy, white, suburban family. And that time she was in hospital, she felt that she was sick. She believed what the doctor said. She was ashamed of herself. She felt she was mad, and she went into the hospital willingly, hoping to be cured of this madness. The second time she went in, however, was a different story. She wasn't ashamed. She knew she wasn't sick, she was just angry. The way she got in that time was because her niece came around, who was the only person she had left that she was close to, who had just been beaten up by her pimp boyfriend because she was pregnant by him and he wanted her to have an abortion. Gerardo, the pimp, comes around to her flat and with a dodgy doctor to do the operation. Starts beating up Dolly again and hits Connie. So Connie smashes a wine jug in his face, and this is why she's committed. She's signed into hospital by her brother Louis, who's Dolly's father, and Gerardo the pimp. So this time she knows she's not mad. She never once believes the doctor's accusations that she's sick. She knows that she's simply angry, and in fact she looks back with some pleasure on what she did. Because this time she didn't internalise her anger, her pain. She didn't strike out at her daughter or herself. She struck out at Geraldo, who she saw at that moment as the enemy. He embodied, for her, the enemy, and which she says, in him she saw her father, who beat her every week of her childhood. She saw her second husband, who abused her. And she saw the man who raped and abused her in Chicago, causing her to run to New York. So she thinks it's a good thing what she did to Gerardo, and to take some pleasure in the fact that his nose will never look quite the same. She clearly and consistently sees right through the medical and welfare system what they're trying to do. She understands clearly her position in society as a working class Mexican woman. She's not a passive victim, not this time anyway. She knows it's the system that's created this anger in her, and then been unable to contain it, and that's locked her up. She describes the hospital as that place of punishment, of sorrow, of the slow or fast murder of the self called rough overstate, where all who were not desired were caught like rough teeth in the cobwheels, who had no place or fit crosswise, the one they were hammered into, were carted to repent of their contrariness, or to pursue their mad vision down to the pit of terror. Her hospital life has consisted of sitting around in drugged boredom, being forced to take the drug Thorazine every day, which Connie describes as killing her by inches. Patients are punished for disobedience or self-expression and rewarded for conformity and deference. If you thought you weren't sick, it's a sign of sickness, and if you disagreed with anything or complained about anything, that's further sign of your madness. So the hospital has this self-serving philosophy keeping people in it. The author describes some of the other patients in the hospital. They're all quite sane, and what they have in common is that they refuse or they're unable to conform to what society expects of them. Alice is a black woman who boasts that she's never been touched by a man unless she wanted it. She carries a knife and uses it on any man that tries, and this is presumably why she's ended up in the hospital. She knows that she's a prisoner, as all the other patients do, and she acknowledges that. She sees the doctor as her enemies, and through all their jargon, just says clearly that what they don't like is she does what she wants. Skip is a young man who's homosexual, who's been in institutions from the age of 13, put in there by his parents. He says, "My parents thought I didn't work right, so they sent me to be fixed." Now, both of these patients end up having the surgery for them, and the electrodes placed in their brain and some radio sort of device, which can be mean that an outside person, the doctors, can change their moods or adjust their moods at their will. Alice loses all her spirit and ends up sort of very passive and unrecognisable. Skip ends up killing himself, as he tried so many times before but hadn't succeeded. Sybil is Connie's best friend in the hospital. She considers herself a witch, and she considers the psychiatric system as a modern, more cost-effective method of burning at the stake. She too knows exactly what's going on around her. She says they want to control them by turning them all into machines that will obey them. She's also celibate, which is further evidence for her madness for the medical establishment. I'll just read a bit about Sybil, because I like Sybil. This is Connie. "Oh, Sybil was crazy, but Connie had no trouble talking to her. Sybil was persecuted for being a practicing witch, for telling women how to heal themselves and encouraging them to leave their husbands, for being lean and crazily elegant and 5'10" in her bare, long, high-arched feet, for having a loud, penetrating voice and a back that would not stoop, and a temper that stood up in her, lashing the tail of a lioness. Sybil did not hesitate to take to her fists against anyone, so she had a scar across her high, domed forehead coming down to take a white bite of her left eyebrow. Sybil had lost her tooth, her front tooth, and she had a little bald spot she could find her. She wanted to show Connie where her hair had been pulled out by an attendant, the time before last when she had been forcibly committed. Why did she like Sybil so much? Her heart warmed when she saw Sybil's long body writhing in fury. Sybil had high carved cheekbones and a square jaw, a haughty nose and eyes of a smoky umber. On the outside she wore outrageous makeup and ringed her eyes black, but inside they wouldn't let her near her precious pole. Mainly, Sybil was a fighter, and she fought those who threatened her instead of hating her own self. She didn't deny herself. She had not sold herself to any man. Connie adored the way she fought and wouldn't give up or go under. It wouldn't be broken. So that's why Sybil is considered mad and imprisoned in the hospital. One example of a woman on the outside of the hospital who is described is Dolly, who's Connie's niece, who works as a prostitute. Dolly is content enough with her life, her lot, as long as the pimp she has at the time doesn't beat her up too often, as long as he gives her some money now and again. She's permanently high on drugs. She's more incoherent than the patients in the hospital who are on Thorazine. And she's given her daughter to be looked after by her mother. But Dolly is considered by society to be sane. She represents one form of womanhood that doesn't warrant her being locked up, but to be free. Now, I'll talk about the nightmare future. There's only one chapter about it in the book, but it's useful as a contrast to the utopian future. It's a strict hierarchy. It says total gender polarity. Everyone in that future is owned by what's called a multi, which is presumably a multinational sort of company. The Richies and the multi clans live upstairs, which is on spaceship platforms, because the Earth has become so polluted that no one who has the money will live on it. In fact, the yellow smog is so thick you can only see a few feet in front of you. The people who live on the ground are called duds, and these are the workers who have a pretty miserable life and are described as walking organ banks. The ruling class who live on the space platforms all have armies of genetically engineered fighters. Some are improved so-called humans, and some are called cybos that are completely manufactured and contain no animal tissue. Gildina is the woman that Connie meets in this future, who's a catcher, but obviously doesn't know it. She boasts that her boyfriend, who's called Cash, has been through mind control and can switch off fear, pain, fatigue and sleep. He has super neurotransmitters ready to be released into his brain to give him basic killer drive and a bay centre. So that obviously relates to what's happening in the present in the hospital. That's a potential of how it could go. Cash, although he's improved, isn't quite yet an assassin, which is the most improved male. An assassin comes into Gildina's apartment, or Cash's apartment at the end. He's 7 feet tall, completely hairless. He has an unnaturally deep voice, in one hand modified into a weapon. His sex drive has been turned to killer drive. So he's a sort of caricature of masculinity. Gildina was called a contractee. These are women who were contracted to a man for sex for various periods, one night to 10 years, usually about a year, I think, and confined to his apartment complex. She's never been out. No one can go out due to security. Everything's monitored. So contractors would make enough for support, and if they're lucky, for re-ops, maintenance of shots, their clothes and drugs. And these re-ops and maintenance of shots are genetic and plastic surgicals. The other thing that women could be in the nightmare future is, well, they could be contractors like Gildina, they could be duds and live on the ground. There could be moms who are there simply to have babies, and not much is said about them, but they're considered ugly. Riches, presumably, some of the riches were women. And the sort of failed contractors lived in the brothels. So, Cash is a cartoon of masculinity. Gildina is a cartoon of femininity. She has a tiny head, big hair, a tiny waist, wrists and ankles, ridiculously small feet, huge breast, hips and thighs, and in fact, when she gets up, she can hardly walk, she can't balance herself. But she doesn't need to walk because she never goes out. By her bed, she has an automatic pill dispenser containing risers, soothers, sleepers, walkers, euphors, passion pills, which calls the whole works. Unfortunately for Gildina, when the assassin comes in, he's not pleased that she's been talking to Connie, and sends her to the organ bank, where duds go after they stop working, the rest of the subversives are dismantled. So that is one possible future in the book. And when Connie first goes time travelling, she's taken to the utopian future. And when she opens her eyes, she's expecting to see, presumably, skyscrapers and neon lights. But in fact, what she sees is a sort of peasant-like community, a rural, pleasant environment. The village is called Mataprasset. Luciente is the person who takes her there and informs her that we're all peasants now. There's 600 in the village. All villages are working towards becoming self-sufficient in food. They're still working towards this because they're still trying to improve the land that's been ruined by years of war and capitalism. There are no big cities, although she's told these had been tried and deemed not to work. The buildings were low and mostly small, and people potted around walking or cycling, and animals were roaming around as well. So Connie's first reaction was that things had gone backwards. But she's told that they'd learned a lot from societies people used to call primitive. Primitive technically, she's told, but socially sophisticated. We tried to learn from cultures that dealt well with handling conflict, promoting cooperation, coming of age, growing a sense of community, getting sick, aging, going mad and dying. Our ideas make us see ourselves as partners with water, air, birds, fish and trees. So they saw remaining human, as opposed to becoming plastic robotic computers, as more important than solving social problems such as death. The people reminded Connie of her grandparents' society, which was a distant memory of a disintegrating society in Mexico. The children in the centre of things, people always touching each other, and a feeling of community and fiesta. And one of the first places she visits is the Fuda, which is the communal eating house, which is one of the few big buildings. And she finds it's very lively. A child climbs onto a bench, waving his or her arms to tell a story. A man weeps while all around him make a fuss over him. People are arguing, laughing and telling jokes, and the child is singing loudly. Connie thought it could be the dining hall in a madhouse, the way people let their emotions pour out. They were all like children, with every emotion having a physical outlet. So Luciente remarks to her, there was much good in the life the ancestors led here on this continent before the white man came conquering. There was much brought that was useful. It has taken a long time to put the old good with the new good into a greater good, but I have this sort of simple wisdom about them. And so the society really resembles ancient hunting, or the hunting and gathering societies of the past, more so than traditional ideas of a future, even a utopian future. But these hunting and gathering societies of the past did last for 2 to 2.5 million years, and it's estimated that 90% of people who have ever lived have lived under these conditions, and societies that have been characterised by much greater social equality that's existed and has existed since. And one of the starkest contrasts between the nightmare future and the utopia is that in the utopia there's great gender similarity as opposed to the gender polarity in the other one. Luciente, who's Connie's friend who takes her into the future, she assumed for a long time to be a man because, looking back on it, she realised it's because Luciente moves with confidence. She sprawls herself out rather than sitting down. She takes up a lot of space rather than present-day women who take up as little space as possible. Also, in the society, she observes that there's no differentiation of tasks between men and women, including the tasks of birthing, mothering, suckling, etc. This also isn't that inconceivable. Sheila Luinak, in her book Women in Work, has a passage on physical similarities between men and women in hunting and gathering society. The consequence of women's primary economic responsibility was that the differences in physique of the sexes was not as marked as in modern industrialised societies. Zuxum and Baxter is two people she's describing from the Sand people in the Kalahari. Zuxum is 4 centimetres taller than her hunter Baxter. Like many Sand men, Baxter had highly developed mammalian glands so that, as Freitas Joe dos Santos noted, sometimes men were able to suckle. The similarity of females to males was a worldwide feature among Stone Age peoples. It was noted in Polynesia by Captain James Cook among the Bantu, and among West Europeans and North and Central Asian peoples. The muscular development of women in hunting, gathering and strenuous work like processing hides was further encouraged by their role as warriors and defenders of their camps and villages. Much later, the Chinese Emperor Fu He decreed that women should distinguish themselves by their habits, so difficult was it to tell the sexes apart, while the Kuki and Maori tribes of Assam introduced different hairstyles to make clear the distinction between females and males. Look, my next section I called Connie's Conversion, by which I mean, at the beginning, she's very sceptical about the society she visits, and she doesn't particularly like the people. They're very different from her. And I think her hatred of them is first sparked by the time when she sees a man breastfeeding his baby and she feels quite sick. She says something like, the women here think they've achieved equality, but what's special now about being a woman? She scorns and says, what do these people know? Babies are born in a sort of communal brooder, as it's called. She describes them as those bland, bottle-born monsters of the future, born without pain, multicoloured like a litter of puppies, without the stigmata of race or sex. So at this stage, I think she equates being human with having suffered, because obviously she suffered in her childbirth, but she suffered from stigmata of race and sex. The first time she her conversion takes place, or when her conversion takes place, I think, is when she's in the future and she realises that it's actually a much better place for human beings to be than the present where she's come from, especially for her, who's coming from an institution. Luciente's child, Dawn, is coming running towards her, who reminds her very much of her own child, Angie. And Dawn is happy, healthy, well-fed. And this is her reaction to it. Suddenly, she is centred with all her soul to Angelina in Mataposet. To Angelina, hidden forever, 150 years into the future, even if she should never see her again. For the first time, her heart is centred to Luciente, to be to Magdalena. Yes, you can have my child. You can keep my child. Even with your obscenities and your talking cats, she will be strong there, well-fed, well-housed, well-taught. She will grow up much better and stronger and smarter than I. I assent. I give you my battered body as recompense and my rotten heart. Take her, keep her. I want to believe she is mine. I give her to Luciente, to mother, with gladness I give her. She will never be broken as I was. She will be strange, but she will be glad and strong, and she will not be afraid. She will have enough. She will have pride. She will love her own brown skin and be loved for her strength and her good work. She will walk in strength like a man and never sell her body. And she will nurse her babies like a woman and live in love like a garden, like that children's house of many colours. People of the rainbow with its end fixed in earth, I give her to you. And after this first experience that makes her realise that the future is a better place, she soon comes to see the potentials of other people from her present and from her past and the future. And most importantly, herself, the potential of herself in that future. There's also Martin, her husband, who had died a long time ago. Paro is someone from the future. Paro fascinated her. She could be no more than 21 or 22, yet she was serving as people's judge, doctor of rivers. She herself could be such a person here. Yes, she would study how to fix the looted landscape, heal rivers choked with filth, doctor the soil squandered for a quick profit on cash crops. Then she would be useful. She would like herself, as she had done during the brief period she had been involved in the war on poverty hope. People would respect her. There's Consuelo, they'd say, doctor of soil, protector of rivers. Her children would be proud of her. Her lovers would not turn from her, would not die in prison, would not be cut down in the streets like Martin. Then he had his respect, his dignity. He could have had his work and his leisure and his life. So I saw her conversion as not being an intellectual one, and not solely intellectual one, born of her feelings, her experience, in the fact that she'd been able to visit that future. So she wants that future to come about rather than the other, because she sees the potentialities of the people she loves and herself and the people of the future. Those people have dignity, they're useful, they have a community and a cooperative way of living. In that future, people are able to live as thieving human beings. She realises that the doctors in the hospital believe in itself to be a disease. They wanted to cut out her feelings and place in her brain a machine that would rule them like a thermostat. There's a time when they're operating on her to do this operation on her, which is opening her skull to insert electrodes into her brain. She has a vision of the doctors. She describes them as cold, calculating, ambitious, believing themselves rational and superior. They chase the crouching female animal through the brain with a scalpel, which I thought was a good image. But from an early age, Connie had been told that what she felt was unreal and didn't matter. But in Mataposet, she learned to trust and acknowledge her feelings as real and as true, and she was therefore able to embrace that future as one fit for human beings to live in. The present system, on the other hand, which puts profit and technology before people, can't accommodate human emotions and human feelings, which is why it needs psychiatric institutions and prisons. Now, a big theme with the book is gender, and I think Luciente speaks sort of the author's ideas on gender. And there's just a couple of ideas she has that I don't particularly agree with or have a view on, but I'll put them anyway. Well, the author sees gender polarity as going hand in hand with that technological, genetically engineered nightmare, and the lack of that division as being conducive to a cooperative, humane society. Luciente at one point comments that profit-orientated greed was originally a manifestation of sexism, which poses the question that I think what role did becoming a patriarchy play in the coming about of property societies? Luciete also says that before their revolution, men and women suffered from a biological enslavement, whereby women had babies and suckled and brought them up, and men didn't. And she says that when this revolution took place, men had to give up all their powers. So women had to give up their one and only power, which is that, in order for there to be no more power. You see, that, to me, seems a bit of a contradiction from the first one, because before property societies came about, we still had this biological enslavement, and we didn't have patriarchy or male domination. In fact, primitive women received a lot of respect as women for their role as childbearers. But that's more theoretical. The book on gender, again, the book is specifically about a working class woman and how working class women experience the oppression of capitalist society. Her struggle is against poverty, an oppressive state machine, and a male-dominated society, as well as the working class men who have abused her. So she's not just fighting against economic enslavement, but she's fighting for a freedom of movement and expression, simple freedoms. She imagines at one point being able to live without fear. She imagined herself taking a walk at night under the stars. She imagined herself ambling down a country road and feeling only mild curiosity when she saw three men coming towards her. She imagined hitching a ride with anyone willing to give her a ride. She imagined answering the door without fear to see if anyone needed help. But these are the simple freedoms that women don't have. I do like books and films and television programs that portray what it's like to be a woman in society, because it is, women do experience capitalism in a different way to men. And I think books like this help to validate women's experience and validate the fact that women's fear and of violence, or the threat of violence, is real and can be expressed and should be expressed. It is, in the book, it is Geraldo, Louis, her brother, and the medical system that imprisoned Connie. It's the fear of male violence that imprisons her in her own home when she's outside hospital, and male domestic violence itself that made her a victim inside her own home. So all this fear and this oppression is on top of an economic and welfare system, keeping women and their children in poverty, and a state with the power to take away their children and lock you up in a psychiatric hospital if you don't conform to society's ideas of womanhood. Well, there's just a bit of a description about electric shock treatment, which makes the point. They will send voltage smashing through your brain and knock your body into convulsions. After that, they'd give you oxygen and let you come back to life, somebody's life, jumbled, weak, dribbling saliva. Come back from your scorched taste of death, parts of your memory forever burnt out. A little brain damage to jolt you into behaving right. Sometimes it worked. Sometimes a woman forgot what had scared her, what she had been worrying about. Sometimes a woman was finally more scared of being burnt in the head again, as she went home to her family and did the dishes and cleaned the house. Then maybe in a while she would remember and rebel, and then she'd be back for more barbecue with her brain. So even better than to read how bad it is to be a woman is to see portrayed or re-portrayed the positive features of women's culture, and the close, loyal friendships, the love and courage in bringing up their children, the ability to empathise and to communicate openly and fully with other people. The title of the book, Woman on the Edge of Time, is obviously because she's time-travelling through different times. But a bit deeper, I went, it seems that women have been on the edge of time throughout changes in social system and changes in technologies, as well as being involved in struggles to retain rights and employment rights and land, etc. Women have always been there, caring for the young, the elderly, the sick, providing homes, food and clothing, and basically doing the essential work that keeps all societies going, largely unpaid and ignored by historians, anthropologists and novelists. But I think this role has meant that women have escaped some of the dehumanisation process and the alienation that men have suffered. And the author sees the struggle for the future as being one between even more dehumanisation taking place, or a future where we regain our humanity and use our technology and our institutions to aid and promote that humanity. But I think women's literature does and must give us a fuller picture of working class life, and also in celebrating the positive features of women's culture, and their characteristics of caring and cooperating can help direct us towards a more free and a humane society, or a free humane society. But just to go back again to Hunters and Gatherers, as I said, for most of our history, we have lived in this cooperative, humane manner. And I think the potential is strongly there in us still, because it's not that long that we haven't lived like that. So I don't think it's so much we have to learn new skills and new ways of relating to each other that human beings have never tried or experienced before, but rather we've got to discard all the new negative traits that have been forced upon us by a property, money, society. And when we've managed to shed them, and underneath, I think, what I put here, the loving, cooperative human beings, we have to shine through. That's it.